We welcome writer Colin Fleming to the program. His brand new book out right now. Get your hands on it. It's part of the 33 and a third series. Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Mine finally arrived today. Colin, in my 10 minutes between jobs, I went home, let the dog out, and boom, there was my book. I can't wait to start it.
The excitement commences for my soul-tastic buddy.
No question about it, and I know it's going to be great, but I can't wait to dig in myself. And I glimpsed a little bit. I snuck a peek or two in there, and it looks typically fantastic, and I can't wait to dive in.
I'll be awaiting your considered input.
I'm going to go, yeah, good read, man. Two thumbs up. I'll do more than that. I will...
Thanks, bro.
Some pithy comment that you can share on a dating site.
Yes, it's going wonderfully well. my forays and romance. Although, you know what I did do today? So when I was at the bookstore the other day, I was coming back from running stairs at BC, and I figured it would be like, I'd be a traitor to myself if I didn't get a copy, right?
Although right.
It's like I don't really have money to spend, but there I was. I thought, I'll help the cause. So I actually hadn't seen the book because I hadn't given them my address for like a box of the books that they were going to send me. So I went down to the Starbucks today and I gave a copy of this book to this smoking hot barista who's been really nice to me. I'm kind of teasing. Well, she is smoking hot. But even if she wasn't, I would have given her a copy of the book because she's been a smiling presence in my life. There aren't many of those, as you know, for a couple of years. So, and plus, it also answers the query that I'm sure they all have. What does this guy do all day? Why does he just pop down here in the sweatpants that he had on yesterday? What's up with this guy? And now there's no excuse not to get my name right.
Right. Well, there you go. Do they spell it right? Because I can also see that happening in a Starbucks when they write it on the cup. How many colons have there been?
It's pretty rare. I was Callum. Quite recently, and
Callum, you know as well as I do, every Callum is secretly a Chad.
Well, it's funny because Colin isn't like not that rare of a name like in England. I don't even think it's not like a terribly rare name now. It's not like I'm Bartholomew or anything like that. But everybody puts the extra L, which is never or very rarely how it's spelled anyway. And it's funny because there's this one woman at the Starbucks, and she's probably been there 5, 6, 7 years, and I know everybody's name, and I don't think that I'm probably good with that. So, like, I'm wearing, if I'm teaching, the thing that I'd come to you for advice would be is on remembering the names. I just have this weird, like, phobia that I won't know anyone's name at the end of the semester if I do, like, a celebrity turn as a writer. And it's also a good way to meet people. Oh, no, it's wrong. But you know what I'm saying. And so this woman looks at me like she's never seen me before every single time. And it's like, your name? Like really? Are you like gaslighting me here? Like, what? Are you that thick? Like, how can you? I don't even like you when I know your name. She's like, whoa, that's really aggressive, sir. I'm like, sorry, my bad.
See, I'm really good at learning the names. And I'm good with this year. But I will run into students, not all students, and some if I work with and like theater and stuff like that. But if I run into students, I may remember the name, but I'll have no idea what class. So I'll say, now you were a class of what, 97? And they'll be like, no, last year. Oh, right. So I can only make room for so much up there.
I'm worried, like if I was at BU, which I was supposed to be doing, and then COVID hit, I'm worried that I'm going to be like, let's just give up the ghost. You, meathead idiot in the back, what do you have to say? Hot girl in the front, good take. I'm worried that I'll just resort to that. And I was saying to someone, they were horrified. I said, I don't intend to have a career in teaching. So I can mix teaching and romance.
I'm going to recommend against that here. It's harder with masks.
You of all people. We'll have a private conversation about later. But yeah, of course, you of all people. I understand.
It's harder with masks to learn names. I found out. And then today, I'm trying to remember them all just in my head. I want them to think I know all their names already, but there are a few I get confused on, and I'm looking at two, and they got the same name. We'll call them Aiden, because that was their names. And I'm like, oh, which one's Aiden? Which one's Aiden? And then I look down, and I realize they're both Aiden. Oh, you had me.
I would figure students have a leg up with you if they wanted to get into broadcasting, that they could query you about being your little intern or something.
And I tell them, no, get it.
Oh, really? Well, did they ever ask, is any of them like precocious?
I've had a couple over the years, and I tell them, do you like eating? Would you like to own a house at some point in your life and enjoy some of the good things? This may not be the profession for you.
Well, the thing is, I was saying this to someone, if I was to say to a person, like, you suck at writing, you should do something else with your life, somebody who's going to be successful anyway, they're not going to listen.
Right,
they're going
right.
to find their own way. Do you know what I mean? So, like, that person that you might say to, there's no money in this for you, is going to think, yeah, well, screw you, old man. We'll see where the money is.
Oh, yeah, but you can also, you can weed people out that way, too.
Sure, because if you're going to make it in something like that, unless it's just given to you, which is often how it works. But if you were someone who had it in you to make it anyway,
right?
Yeah, that could upset you, certainly. And you could mull and get down over that. But you're ultimately going to find your own way. So it doesn't even really matter whether you're right or wrong.
Because, you know, a lot of high school students look at me and all they see is the glamour of being a big-time AM radio broadcaster in the bustling metropolis of Bangor, Maine.
Well, I'm sure a lot of them know the show, and a lot of them know the guests you have on.
They have no idea. They don't even know I have a show. They have nothing.
Really?
I will have students who will say to me every year, you should be on the radio. You've got a really good voice. Thanks. Maybe I'll try that later at some point.
D plus. No, I mean, there must be. I'm sure there are some. Haven't you done this for, like, you've done the show, this particular show, for 10 years.
Yes.
You've taught for the decades now. Yeah. So I'm sure there's some wide-eyed kid who can say, oh, Mr. Kimball, your dulcet tones, I crank my AM radio so loud. And you do it for me and for my family and for everyone. We're just huge, huge fans.
It's when it happens, it's, I had to listen to you on the radio because my dad was listening. Oh, that's fantastic. Thanks for the ringing endorsement, okay. Scooter. How's your grade going?
Yeah, well, maybe ring up the dad. Get a couple of, I know this guy who always has to go to parties and his meathead comes up to him and says, so, bro, are we crushing some Sammy's? And he means Samuel Adams beer.
Oh.
Yeah, be like, let's get some Sammy's.
Yikes. All right, well, let's talk about some of the things on our agenda this afternoon. We've got lots to get to. And let's begin with what in many ways is, if not the birth of the blues, pretty close to it here, and that's the great recordings that Alan Lomax did of Muddy Waters at Stovall's Plantation 80 years ago.
I guess you'd say that it's close to being the birth of Chicago blues, because before this, 1941, you had the gang, you had Robert Johnson and Son House and Charlie Patton, all those kinds of guys doing their Mississippi Delta thing. But this is important because these are acoustic recordings, and it's not like Muddy Waters was a slave or anything like that. He was a sharecropper, so he had a house. And Alan Lomax was this guy who worked for the Library of America. He's going to feature in a book I'm going to be doing in the near future, because he would make these field recordings, and he would make recordings of, like, the just mentioned Son House. He would make recordings of Woody Guthrie, all kinds of people. Make prison recordings, spirituals, field recordings, field hollers, all of that. Invaluable, the work he did. Lead Belly, so many people he ended up working with. And so he goes down to Stovedale and he meets with Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters is a young guy at the time. He's not going to be playing the blues that he's known for, that heavy, amplified, loud. And you have to understand how loud Chicago Electric Blues was. It was like heavy metal before heavy metal, but a lot much more idiomatic in that sort of like American vein than you'd get with like Led Zeppelin, all that sort of stuff. So he's playing acoustic guitar. And he's playing it really well. And Lomax sends him like a pressing of the recordings that they made in 1941. He's back in 1942, makes a few more. Muddy Waters hauls it down the street. He goes to, like, the juke joint to put it on the jukebox to hear himself. This was a big moment for Muddy Waters because he realized, like, hey, I'm really good. I'm Muddy Waters. And he hadn't really been thinking that way before. And it was sort of like the cachet of recordings that sent him on his way.
I saw Muddy Waters in concert, improbably, at this little bottle club in rural Maine back in about 1978 or 79. And I remember sitting there with friends and looking around saying, do people realize who we're watching? What a legend this is in this little place in the middle of nowhere, but he put on an amazing show.
There are a lot of stories like that of these blues guys where they're like Keith Richards goes to Chess Records and sees like some legend, like changing a light. And it's like, oh, okay, that's Willie Dixon. And he's like also the janitor. And so there were kind of like these nondescript appearances over the decades with these guys where they were spotted by people in the know, but a lot of other people wouldn't have had an idea. I think that's why groups like the Rolling Stones were so important in amplifying what these guys did. There's very much a symbiotic relationship between someone like Muddy Waters and the Rolling Stones, because they're going to help amplify his presence and his music and get that out into the world and get that better known in the world. And they were writing the songs they were writing in the first place because of the way I put it as the way that someone like Muddy Waters taught them to hear life. A lot of how they would write wouldn't be necessarily based upon the 12-bar structure that Muddy Waters would use, but there was a maturity, a sensibility to his worldview, to how he was open to seeing that world. And I think that was something that he helped teach these English white kids.
And what I love about the Stones and their blues connection, and they weren't the only ones to do this, but they always in interviews, even back in the early 60s, would talk about their heroes and put them out there and expose them to a young audience that had no idea who any of these people were, but would encourage them to go explore for themselves. So it wasn't just a question of doing a cover of their music, but and in later years, getting some of them to open for them and perform with them as well.
There used to be a rite of passage, and I don't really think it is anymore among people who listen. People used to listen far more voraciously. It wasn't just that you would get into a band or a singer or a writer, guitarist, whatever it was. You would then learn everyone that they were into, and that's how you would move on to people like Muddy Waters or Arthur Alexander, the Beatles, or these girl groups and the Shirelles. It's not like necessarily, I mean, you could have if you heard them on the radio, but some of these people you wouldn't hear on the radio at all. And that's just what you did. You went out, and it's almost like in the NFL, you have the coaching tree. Well, this was like the music tree, the music forest, and that's how you got exposed to a lot of artists that became your musical education. And you had to work at the time back then. You didn't just type it in on the keyboard, like, or YouTube or Apple Music or whatever. And I think people don't do that anymore. It's just they have the blinders on and they're missing out on so many things that make life wonderful. Can you imagine going through your life and not hearing Muddy Waters? You would be deprived.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And at a time when it's easier to access it than it's ever been before.
It is. You can, it's like, unless you want to be a doctor, you shouldn't go to college. You're not going to learn anything in college. It's just so easy too. It's so just readily available, everything out there for you. And I've used that to my advantage, and it's helped me pack more meaning and work into my days. But like within the course of a Sunday afternoon, if it's raining outside, you can listen to some Beethoven piano sonatas. You can listen to the Rolling Stones second album. You can listen to Howlin' Wolf live in 1966. You can read a short story by Daniel Carms, whom we've discussed. And it's all just there. Go listen to a Miles Davis record. Go listen to John Coltrane playing with Eric Dolphy. Go listen to some Wagner overtures. It's like 3 hours out of your life. Mm. And then already you're the smartest person you know. I mean, how simple is that? People don't do it.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. From Muddy Waters to a great Beatles song from Revolver that in many ways epitomizes what joy sounds like and feels like, and your bird can sing.
A throwaway song, because it's not like what anyone would put up on the wall as like a just throw down kind of masterpiece. But listening to it the other day, And also there's an early version of it too that you might be familiar with from the second anthology album where they're trying to add on to the vocal, Lennon and McCartney, and they're just both cracking up through the entire performance, which they did quite a bit. There's a version of If I Fell from Vancouver in 1964 where they laugh the entire whole way through and crack each other up. But it's not even so much the lyric that codifies the joy, because the lyric itself is tantamount to a cautionary tale. This idea of when your prized possessions start to weigh you down, look in my direction, I'll be around. It's like kind of a warning song. Same way that She Loves You is a warning song. The way She Loves You functions, and it's really clever, is like if you don't treat this person who likes you the right way, you're going to lose her. Kind of like an epistle to a buddy from the Beatles, like to put it in like a kind of like biblical sense. And so this song is like ringing major key song with this guitar track, this overdub layered guitar track to die for. It's so many guitars at once. And the Beatles didn't really do a lot of that. To me, it does epitomize joy in sonic form, the overall presentation of the music. It's like really this transmutation of the absolute sound, the actual sound of joy.
And I love the stories about it, that perhaps the song was written about Frank Sinatra. Perhaps it was written about Mick Jagger, and the Beatles never really talked about that.
No, they had Jagger on the mind around these years of 65, 66, because Rubber Soul from the year before was sort of a reference to Mick Jagger, because black musicians would hear this white guy Jagger and they'd say Plastic Soul Man, Plastic Soul. So Plastic Soul became Rubber Soul, which is also a bad pun. The Beatles did a bunch of bad puns that end up kind of working, because retroactively you don't look at them as puns. Like Revolver itself is a pun. It doesn't refer to a gun. It refers to this is what the record does. It revolves. So you had this song where their throwaway was more of a success than what a lot of bands achieve in their career. And I think just the idea of the singing bird is sort of rooted in English art. There's that poem, John Keats, it's like in No Bird Sings. It's like that's how desolate this particular woodlands is. So the Beatles are doing the converse of that with this song of the full-throated singing bird.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. We're going to talk a little sports and a favorite topic of mine, those non-star athletes that one admires. And for me, that's most of my sports fandom, is loving those guys who are not the stars.
I was thinking about some of mine today from the four major sports, and there are some stars in there, but they're not like anyone that anyone looked at like really as a big star. Or like one example, for instance, is Tom Bernanski in baseball. He had that stint with the Red Sox, and he had I remember the back of the baseball card sometimes, like he's hit 20 home runs 6 years in a row, and only like Dwight Evans and Bernanski and someone else had done it. But it's not like really wow, right? It's just kind of like okay. And so like someone like that, now they might have made an all-star team or two, but they were never like among the very best in the league. Baseball for me, I have quite a few catchers on this list. You know I like catchers. So like Matt Noakes, he had that one really big year, his rookie year. He had 30 home runs, 32 home runs, I think it was, which is crazy. And Benito Santiago, who is actually really good when you look at like his gold gloves and silver sluggers, but he was never like some superstar in the league. He was just like a cool guy who played with a lot of personality that you like. So like that kind of contributor.
It's interesting. You went with catchers, and most of mine ended up being second baseman, probably because as a young kid, that's where I played most often. And for me, it was guys like Mike Andrews, Marty Barrett in later years, Bobby Gritch, Glenn Beckert. Those were the guys that I loved. And if they would have a year where they hit 285 or 290, I would celebrate.
I like Bill Doran. He was
Yes.
And the guy who stood out to me, too, he won an MVP. It's probably the worst year anyone's ever had to win an MVP in anything, in a way. Marty Marion was a shortstop
right,
for the St. Louis Cardinals, and he won an MVP in the mid-40s during the war years. And, like, his OPS plus was, like, 70 or something like that, 68. It was crazy. And like he had a low average, absolutely no power at all. But you get the sense that he was just this maven defensively. He was this leader. And he did things now. It turns me off the analytics. Everything is a contest of war. And you have to use your eyes. There's more to everything than that. There's not just more to baseball than that. There's more to life than that. What does it look like? Because your senses will tell you something. And it means something when there's a guy on second and there's nobody out and it's a tight contest and you scoop the ball out of the dirt on this low throw the inning before, the catcher threw you to nail a guy who's trying to steal second. And then you come up and that guy's on second, nobody out, and you ground out to the second baseman. You get him over to third so someone can just drive him in with a sacrifice fly. And that kind of intangible, it's just not, it doesn't even, it's like obsolete now. But it's not obsolete when it comes to the W's and the L. It still adds up. I was thinking about like this Red Sox team. I know they're metrics for defense, but how many games do you think their fielding has cost them this year?
Oh,
10 games?
Oh, easily.
12
yes.
games?
Yeah.
I mean, if they don't make the playoffs, it's going to be two things. It's going to be defense mostly, and then like their weird COVID strategies that they've done or not done, whatever it is. But like those things, they don't play solid, fundamental baseball. They're also just not good at that. Like they're lax in basic kind of spring training stuff. So for baseball, those guys, and then like in football, I was like Steve Barkowski. He just had like a big arm.
Yeah.
At the time, it was rare to throw for three. Well, it wasn't that rare, but it's not like it is now. But throwing for 3,000 yards was a big deal. And locally, I was thinking, because he's kind of a star, but you really can't be a star at this position unless you're a Ray guy. Rich Camarillo, the punter for the Patriots. Do you remember him?
I do. I do. Now, I liked punters. I loved Ray Guy from the Oakland Raiders back in the day.
But he's a stud. He's the best
at
his position.
He was.
He's in the
Hall
of Fame.
But he's still a punter.
Yeah, right. So, like, he still sort of gets the asterisk. But he is, I mean, I believe he's the only punter in Canton, right? Unless you go back to the days when guys played two ways.
Right,
and
right.
So, like, the offensive lineman, like the center, was like, I shall kick the field goals. Like, so you could have guys who are in the Hall of Fame that way. But I think Ray Guy is the only, like, full-time punter thus far that's in the Hall of Fame. And he was actually a weapon. I remember Belichick talking about him one time. And when you do, like, really, and I don't do this that often because I'm always busy doing other things, but when you really dial in and watch a football game, you see how vital field position is. It's, like, so important to the game. It shifts momentum. It shifts mood. It shifts the timbre of games. It is a way to get a foothold of momentum when things aren't going your way because field position begets opportunity. And so Ray Guy, I remember watching him, he'd punt and he'd like the ball would go out of bounds at the 6-yard line. I'm thinking like, how does he do that every time? That's really weird. And it's just like the extension of his follow through. He was like this Mary Lou Redden type, like doing the vertical split.
Field position crucial, he said with a brilliant segue here, in low-scoring games. You and I are both fans of those. I think true fans love low-scoring games. That's the best.
I'm getting more into them again. I mean, really what I'm interested in is a well-played game where teams make plays and then it's not so much about the miscues. Certainly not the mental miscues, or the miscues come because somebody else has been so forceful in dictating the way the game is going to go, and that prompts a response. But just if you look at go to NFL.com and just look at the scores, it's like 38-34, and it's just too easy. There's not enough drama for me. There's more drama. Some of these games, a well-played 10-3 game. One of the better hockey games I've seen in fairly recent years was that Lightning Bruins conference championship game, that game 7, that 1-0 game, Tim Thomas said the Bruins were going to win the cup that year. And there was like no shortage of action in the game. And so every play counts for more. The strategy counts for more. The Red Sox played a great one the other night, which they actually managed to win. And they're typically bungling games, but it was like more satisfying because it just was so airtight the entire way through, whatever the final ended up being.
Even that game they lost 2-1 the other night to the White Sox was a great game, a lot of big pitching. And when you've got a game that's scoreless into the seventh inning, every defensive play, every pitch means even more, it seems.
Yeah, and the one I'm thinking about is the Renfro game. So
throw
earlier in the game and over near the tarp. And then he hits the home run when they're looks like they're going to lose. And then he makes that play. And the thing people I don't think realize about that play, people focus on the throw. Because the throw is measurable, and they can measure the distance and the velocity. You have to use your eyes. The hardest thing about that play was that he has to run the ball down with his back away from home plate. And he has to stop. All his momentum's taken him that way. It's not like you're coming in on a fly ball and you take that crow hop. So now he has to regather, turn, and like kind of one motion and throw the ball like on a laser beam type arc. That was the hardest thing. It's hard to pick up a ball anyway rolling away from you. Like, you have to reach out with the glove. You have to guesstimate and go over a certain amount, because it's like leading someone with a pass. Like, if you don't lead them, they'll go behind them, obviously. So it's like that kind of concept. And things like that really tell in a low-scoring game. And I think, like, I'd sent you, like, some weird kind of box score of a football game a while back. I really sort of would have dug college football in 1937. I would have been into that, where it is, like, 7-3, and it's just so, like, violent. But it's a controlled violence.
Well, and where if they threw the ball, it was maybe 3-4 times a game, and it was like the Minnesota Vikings of the late 60s and early 70s, the 3 yards in a cloud of dust.
Well, I love that team. It wasn't like when I had sent you that link today, Bud Grant, and listeners, we were sort of looking at age today, and Bud Grant is still alive, and he made the Hall of Fame as this coach of, he also played in the early 50s, but he made the Hall of Fame as a coach of the Minnesota Vikings. So I thought that was neat. In 1990, he was the age that you are now.
Yeah.
And when he was my age, he was leading those Vikings to Super Bowl losses against that. One of them was the undefeated Miami Dolphins team. Then the Dolphins repeated the next year. But he was coaching like Fran Tarkenton, and Alan Page, and Carl Eller. And it's just like, when people say there's not enough time, life is so short, I don't know. You sort of have to look at how you treat your days, because this is a guy, again, my age. He was doing his thing at that age, 1943. He's still going, and that just sort of like reframes time. And I love that Vikings team. I thought those defenses were so cool, but I love that you could really root for defensive players. And Alan Page won an MVP. When does defensive players win an MVP now? It's just like such a huge slight. In the NHL, defensemen, they don't win the Hart. Like, you're telling me that the most valuable guy in the league, I mean, it's the premium position now, that number one defenseman. You're telling me he can't be the most valuable guy? And in the NFL, the games are so high scoring. It's so easy to play quarterback that, yeah, maybe a guy gets some sacks and there's a lockdown corner, but I don't know. I feel like it's inequitable. And I want it to be like, okay, Lawrence Taylor, you're the MVP this year, man.
And when you talk about college football in those early days, it was so much bigger than the National Football League was for the first couple of decades anyway of the league. I'd love to go back just for a moment to capture the excitement of one of those big, like a Big Ten matchup, when that was the game, when it was far bigger than anything the Bears or the Packers or the Giants might be doing.
Oh, that would have been awesome. And guys tried to fudge their eligibility
right,
because they wanted to stay on and play the college game. That's where like the stars were. And it's one of the reasons I love that 1937 novel To Walk the Night so much, because I mean, it's a lot of things. It's a horror novel, and it's a sci-fi novel, and a mystery, an electric mystery, buddy novel. But it also begins with these two guys going back to their alma mater, and they live in New York City by that time. They're like 2 or 3 years out of college. And it just gives you the sense of the drama, the scope of being back on campus for something like that, and the roar in the crowd and everything. And I was thinking about this too, because as you know, I ran all these stairs on an empty campus next to an empty football stadium. And I was at the opening BC game couple weekends ago, and I just thought, like, you have this confluence of life in college where people are out, young people are out in the world on their own for the first time, and you're walking amidst them as they're having all of these experiences, and you're having your much more seasoned experiences where they count for more. I was waiting to get the bus the other day when I was running stairs at BC, and there's this girl on this phone, and she was crying, and she kept apologizing to someone who obviously wasn't accepting her apology. And I was tempted to say, don't apologize so much. You're obviously contrite. You probably didn't do anything that bad in the first place. Someone's making you apologize that much. They're not worth it, and you're not going to remember this someday, or you're not going to remember it as significant. But still, to her, it was. And so you have these people coming back to the school where they had all this experience, and the little kids and everything, and it's just different than what you get out at Gillette. And I think that's really why college football, that's why I like it more than the NFL, really.
That's why I enjoy broadcasting and being on campus for games and just soaking up that experience. And part of that's just walking around and seeing the students and their lives and where they are at that point in their life.
It's just this great commingling. It really has, and even if you don't talk to anyone, I was there by myself, it just has this communal vibe to it. And I know some of it's like trashy and tailgating and like there's some god-awful country music playing. It's not like it's Hank Williams and all of that stuff going on. But again, it's just like these various rivers of life meeting in this one sort of like sunny, splashed, autumnal place. And that's just a vibe that you don't get with like the construction workers who were hungover outside of my place talking about like going down to Gillette. It's like, oh, I can't believe we had to wait that long to get in, bro. Do you believe that? Like the tickets, that wouldn't even work at the ushers. Like, I don't know. It's just different. It's not the same. And like I said, that's why I love, one of the reasons why I love that novel so much. I've never seen anyone capture it better in prose.
Colin Fleming, get his new book. Mine arrived today. Get yours soon from the 33 and a Third series, Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Colin, thanks as always. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.